Welcome back once again to season 4 of the podcast. I'm your host, Amanda Blackwood. As many of you know, I wrote my autobiography as a survivor of human trafficking. It's called Custom Justice. But if you didn't know, you do now. Keeping in line with that, this entire season and last season has been focused on interviewing people who did or plan to write about their own experiences as trauma survivors and how they overcame the past. And as much as we all hate commercials, they are a necessary evil these days. This is what keeps the show on the air. You can also show your support by purchasing one of my mini books or donating through PayPal or leaving a review on whatever platform you listen to this podcast on. You can find the links for the books or donation options in the podcast description. As always, a portion of the proceeds go to local organizations that help fight human trafficking. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the podcast. As always, I'm your host, Amanda Blackwood, and I have with me an incredible young lady. She is an author and a speaker, and she has overcome some stuff that you guys might actually find familiar in some of your lives out there. Welcome to the show, Erin Copeland.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here and to share my story with your audience today.
I'm excited to hear your story. There is so much that you do and you work so hard. You are one of these unsung heroes that so many people have not yet heard of and need to.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm not going to disagree. I'm not going to disagree, Amanda. Thank
you. So let's start with one of the very basic, easy questions. Where did you grow up? Where are you originally from?
Oh my goodness. So, one would think this would be easy. So I was born in New York, but I moved when I was small. I was 7 years old and I moved to California. So my family took me across the country. And then I grew up in Santa Cruz, California, which is a lovely, beautiful resort beach town in central California. I moved to Los Angeles and then I ended up migrating back over to Texas and then all the way to Florida. So I've kind of done this whole circle of the United States.
Oh my goodness. You know, all of the places that you mentioned, I have lived myself except for Texas.
Ah, what part of Florida were you in?
I was in Daytona Beach.
Okay, I'm in Fort Lauderdale.
Okay. I know people in Fort Lauderdale. That's interesting. So, Erin, what kind of a trauma did you have to overcome or go through to put you on this trajectory that you've been on now?
You know, I feel like it was a sneaky trauma because I was living it and I really didn't know. I wasn't aware I was living a trauma. So I was the sole caregiver to my husband, Jerry, when he was diagnosed with liver cancer in 2009. And so for over a decade, I was the only person to take care of him through all of his treatments and surgeries and procedures. And then we moved along the way and he had a massive liver resection. So that's when they cut out the sick part of your liver. And so that was very traumatic for both of us. And then we decided to move again because, you know, why not move some more? And we got to Florida. And the day we were moving into our new house, we got the phone call that there was a liver for him for a transplant. Oh. And I will tell this story very, very quickly, but it's one of my favorites. Because people used to ask me, we knew he was on the list. He was on the transplant list for 8 years. Mm. And people would say, when is Jerry getting his transplant? When is Jerry getting his liver? And knowing that we were eventually going to be moving into a new home, I would respond with, as long as it's the day after we move, I'll be fine. And I said it about 100 times, minimum, because that was just my standard response. Because with transplants, you can't schedule a transplant. And so we're moving into the house. The movers got there, start to unload stuff. And I hear my husband on the phone saying, you know, this is really not a good time. And I said, who are you talking to? And he said, oh, it's Karen at Cleveland Clinic. And they have a liver for me, but I'm telling her, like, we're moving. This is not a good time for a transplant. And I grabbed the phone from him. I took the phone out of his hand and I asked how much time we had. And she said, I can give you 15 minutes. to decide. And so, you know, we sat down and had a real heart to heart, like, is, why do you not want a transplant? Or is it literally because we're moving? He said, how can I leave you with all these boxes? Like, this would be a disaster. I said, I can handle boxes. I got boxes. And so we told the movers, dump everything in the house. Let's go. And he was rolled back for surgery at 7 a.m. on the day after we moved.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
And it's been a process. It's been a process, but I am fine.
They say life is what happens when something else is planned, and boy, did you have other plans.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm sure that's probably kind of true of the most of having to deal with his cancer and everything. I'm sure you guys had plenty of other plans that you wanted to go through rather than him having to go through all of this stuff. And a lot of people don't realize how much trauma is involved with having to help a loved one get through cancer treatments.
It is. It's a lot. And that's why I said it's like, you know, they talk about big T traumas, you know, kidnap and rape and war and very major things that you know you have been through a trauma. And then there's what they like to call the little T traumas, and it's just those tiny daily stressors that kind of build up, like me being responsible for filling his pillbox after his transplant. Mm-hmm. Every single day, or every week, I did every week, I knew if I didn't do it properly, he could die. And that was a little trauma for me. And so doing that over a decade, it starts to build up.
Wow.
And it starts to take effect, and it starts to take a toll on your mental health and your physical health.
Right. I mean, in what ways did it really impact you?
For me, it was more mental than physical, but when the mental gets overwhelming, that trickles down into your physical body too, because your body's like, I'm trying to tell you, you have a problem and you need to take care of it. So I will make you sick. I will make you tired. I will exhaust you. But mentally, I could not get my body out of fight or flight. After Jerry's transplant, 2 years post-transplant, the cancer actually came back.
Oh,
it had, excuse me. It metastasized to his adrenal gland, and it just never showed up anywhere until 2 years after the transplant. So we thought we were in the clear. We thought we were good. He was back to work. He like regular life. I was healing, and then boom, back again. And when he had his adrenal gland removed, that's when I had my first physical episode of PTSD. And I got off the elevator in the hospital to see him after surgery. My whole body broke out in a sweat. I could barely move my feet to go down the hall. My brain was screaming, like, stop walking. Like, I was walking into a live firing range. My body just rejected the situation. Wow. I was putting itself in. And I got to his room, and I basically collapsed, and, you know, they have those lovely pleather recliner chairs that like fold out into a bed. It's like a little unit. And I just like, I collapsed in there, and I said to him, I think I just had an episode of PTSD. And my husband, like, he's so chill. And he's like, yeah, I could see that. I could see that. I could see how that could happen. And so just that long mental toll without consistent healing along the way and consistent coping along the way, it built up.
Absolutely. And I love that you were able to describe your PTSD episode. I mean, this is very real stuff. And a lot of people think PTSD is just nightmares and flashbacks, but it has so many different ways that it shows up in our lives.
In very individual ways. Yes. Yeah. Very individual ways. It's whatever way your body thinks you will pay attention.
Yep.
That's how it's going to show up. So maybe the same thing may happen to somebody else, and they think, oh, I'm 50 years old. I'm just having a hot flash. Well, I knew that wasn't the case. I understood what was happening to me, and that my body was trying to protect me from myself.
Yep. Absolutely. So what helped you to heal after going through all of this stuff?
It almost feels cliche to say it, but there's been a lot of therapy, and I really, our friends and our family are wonderful and they can listen, but having somebody that is skilled, and if you can find someone skilled in whatever trauma you're experiencing, like I've met so many therapists that specialize in caregiving, and I never knew that was a thing, but it is a thing.
Honestly, I
They
didn't either.
specialize in treating caregivers because
Wow.
of the level of trauma it can induce on a person. And so finding somebody, and that's easier said than done as well. I can't tell you the number of therapists I have been to, and it's a very individual, personalized thing, and you have to find somebody that you click with, that understands you, that can see you. And see when you show up, they can read your body language, they understand the words you're saying. So it is a process. And for me, my favorite therapists have always given me resources and tools. So they said, you know what? Try reading this book. You know what? Try this meditation tape. You know, try this workbook and different things that weren't just dependent on me sitting in their office. And they gave me tools that I could use every single day and things I could fall back on. So I'm like, okay, I'm feeling this moment. I'm feeling stressed. I can tell I'm overwhelmed. What can I do about it? And I had tools to fall back on.
Very nice. And it really is so important to find the right therapist too. There was a study done a couple years ago that said something like 90% of people who had therapists lied to their therapist. Why are you going to lie to somebody you're trying to pay to help you?
No, and it really is true. I had a therapist once say to me, "You're just so honest. I don't really always know what to do with it." And I said, "Then why would I be here? What am I like? If I'm not going to tell you, then what is the point of me giving you the money? Like, how can you help me?"
Oh
And
my
then
gosh.
I think the other thing that really, really helped me, probably. I can't even say the most because they really go in hand in hand. Because if I hadn't been to the therapy, gone through the therapy, I wouldn't have been able to use my voice. And learning to use my voice and talking about my experiences, because it was very lonely for me. I was a very codependent person, and I really thought I could just do all of it myself. And then if I asked for help, I was somehow less than.
Yeah.
And so I know there's other people out there that are just like me. And so I wrote my book. I speak about the topic. I run workshops on ways to redefine self-care. I try to put out a bunch of free content just to support the community because caregivers don't talk enough about what they're feeling and what they're going through.
Wow. And that's so true. I mean, I didn't experience it for nearly the length of time that you did. But one of my very dear friends received his second diagnosis of pancreatic cancer a few years ago. It was February of 2020, and then the pandemic hit and everything was locked down and I couldn't see him for months. And I went through a bit of a emotional breakdown, not being able to be there for my friend. And when he finally allowed me to be there for him, which this is very common, it doesn't take a lockdown for somebody with cancer to not want you to be there with them. When I was able to be there for him, I started really taking care of him and doing all this cooking and cleaning and physical taking care of my friend in ways that he never predicted he would need somebody to. And he felt like he was losing his dignity. It was really, really tough. It was hard for me to sit there and watch him in this incredible amount of pain and laying in the fetal position on the floor and in tears. But as much as I think about how hard that was on me, I can't even begin to imagine how much harder that was on him.
Oh,
But
absolutely.
at the same time, we have to understand that we cannot put our traumas on a shelf like a trophy. We can't say that one gets first place. I'm nowhere near that. Because that's not how trauma works. It changes who we are.
And trauma hits every single one of us so differently that we need to pay attention to this. We need to pay attention to these PTSD responses, regardless of what other people are going through. We also have to take care of ourselves. It's a scary place to be sometimes.
Absolutely. And that's one of the messages I repeat in my book is, and I apply it to caregivers, but really for everybody in every stage of life, there is no wrong way. There is no right way. There's just love.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're giving all this love to somebody else, and you got to give yourself some too. You have to.
You have to. Yeah. Off the top of my head, I don't remember the statistic off the top of my head, but I think it's something like 60% of caregivers will get sick or pass before the person they're caring for.
Oh my goodness.
Because they do not take it. They miss doctor's appointments. They ignore symptoms and signs, and they don't take care of themselves.
Wow. It's
a huge percentage.
I've always heard that doctors make the worst patients, but that just really brings that home too. You're doctoring somebody else. You're not taking care of yourself.
Yep.
Wow. So how is your husband doing these days? Has he completely recovered?
He is fantastic. Yes, he is just a regular good old husband, and he does his work, and he does his recliner time, and he does the dishes, and he tells me what to do, and he takes out the trash, and yeah, he's excellent.
I love this guy already. He's awesome.
He is awesome. He is awesome.
Oh my gosh. And who inspires you the most?
I really have to say my community. The more caregivers I get to know, I'm inspired every day by caregivers. I mean, they just give endlessly. And the people in my inner circle who support me and cheer me on and encourage me, because the whole using of my voice thing, it's a newer skill. And so like, no, you got this, and it's an important message. And so I am always inspired by those people who encourage me.
That's beautiful. And I understand you have a copy of your book handy. Have you gotten it to where you would be willing to read a little bit for us?
I do, absolutely. So the little section I'm going to read, so the name of the book is Welcome to Caregiving, The Things Caregivers Never Talk About, because that's what the book is about. Didn't want to get all fancy. To the
point. Yes, I love that.
And the beginning of this section is from chapter 15, called Kitchen Table Pharmacist. While it was my least favorite and most frustrating duty, at least being chauffeur was a familiar task. I knew how to drive. I knew where we were going. The other duties as assigned, I was driving blind. The most frightening of my newly acquired duties was by far the kitchen table pharmacist. Jerry and I had never been pill takers. We didn't take vitamins. We didn't take supplements. And through all his treatments and diagnoses, Jerry was never on doctor prescribed medication. Pills were foreign, but seemed like a no-brainer. So you get a pill box, right? Easy peasy. You put pills in the boxes. Piece of cake. You swallow them. Yum. That was my belief until I was handed a shopping bag filled with pills of all different shapes and sizes, all with the related instructions. While physically light, that bag could have been holding the weight of the world in it because I could barely lift it. After spending 6 days in the hospital post-transplant, it was time for Jerry to go home. Representatives from all departments paraded through our room for evaluations and explanations. The social worker to ensure I was equipped to handle his needs. The home nurse representative to schedule our first in-home visit to inspect his wounds, check for fever, and monitor his overall recovery process, also known as making sure I'm not killing him. And the pharmacist for pill taking 101. Pill training. Again, my preconceived beliefs kicked in. You get a prescription, you hand him the pills, he swallows them. What's to be trained? The pharmacist pulled out that large plastic shopping bag, and one by one, she set out 14 amber-colored bottles of various sizes and a humongous blue pill box with 7 columns for the days of the week and 4 little boxes per day. Wait, my brain protested. You are responsible for giving Jerry all of these pills. If you don't do it right, he might die. The chart came out next. Yes, there was a freaking chart. It listed the pills to take in the morning, the pills to take at night, the pills to be taken twice a day, the pills that are taken every other day, the pills that should never be taken together, and what to do if pills are missed. You need to wear gloves when you handle these pills. The pharmacist bent her head forward, searching to see if she could pierce through the glazed look in my eyes, making sure I understood. They're not good for a healthy person to come in contact with. I blinked and nodded so she knew I heard her. These pills were going to keep Jerry alive. They were going to keep him from rejecting his new organ. The responsibility felt like a sack of bricks that was just thrown over my shoulders. She taught me the strategy I use to this day. I set the chart on the kitchen table. I line up the pill bottles in the exact order they're listed on the chart. I open all the pill box flaps on the individual days. I handle one bottle at a time. And this one goes in here? I asked the pharmacist. Yes. She smiled, oh, so patiently. And this one goes in here? Yes. And this one's twice a day? I read the labels and instructions, making sure I understood all of it. It took me an hour to fill that first pill box in Jerry's hospital room. The pharmacist sat with me the entire time, gently caressing her belly as she was 5 months into her pregnancy. With the pill box filled, it was time for insulin training. Fun fact, did you know that it's common for transplant recipients to become diabetic as a side effect of the medications? Me neither. So suddenly, in addition to pills and the pill box, we had glucose test strips, needles, insulin, finger pricks, charts, and meters. In all the overwhelm, I focused on love. We could do this. We would do this. Me and Jerry, Jerry and me. I drove back to the new house, this time with Jerry in tow. It was the first time he had been in our home since the movers dumped everything when we got the call. He took a short exploratory walk to get his bearings and then settled into his recliner with a colander over his tummy to protect it from pouncing kitties who wanted to snuggle their master. I set the shopping bag full of pills and supplies on the kitchen table. The kitchen table pharmacist was born.
Wow. Brilliant about the colander on his tummy to protect him from the cats.
Thank you. That was me. That was my idea.
Oh, how many cats do you have?
Right now we have one. At the time we had three, but now we have one.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Oh. We have six. I had four when I met my husband. He had two. I was convinced I was going to be the crazy cat lady and not interested in a relationship. so when we got married, we just called it a petting zoo.
Yes. Yay. I love that.
And I know what it's like to have the cats want, and animals in general want to be with you and around you when you are recovering from something. They know that there's something up and they want to be with you. They want to comfort you. I don't realize they're actually hurting you in the process.
Right. But he has literal, like, you know, those big staplers that staple like giant legal documents.
Yeah.
Big fat staples. Those were like the staples that were in his abdomen. Oh. And the transplant is like, when they open you up, it leaves like the Mercedes symbol on your abdomen. And cause so that's,
oh my gosh,
is his stomach. So yeah, he didn't want cats jumping on him to snuggle.
No, absolutely not.
No.
Yeah, I had a hysterectomy at 20. I had 42 internal stitches and 22 staples. And they were the big staples like that. And mm-hmm. I did not have any animals at the time. It was great. I could relax. But yeah. I can't imagine what it would have been like to try and protect myself at that point. Oof.
A colander. Yeah.
It's so brilliant,
and it fit perfectly right over his stomach, and it was also awkward enough that, like, if they jumped on the chair where he was reclining, they were like, what is that lump? Like, I don't understand what's happening here. And they would scurry away.
I can't step on that.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. That's not my squishy daddy. I don't know.
Oh my gosh, how cute. So when going through all of this, do you feel like you were an introvert or an extrovert before all of this began? And did that change at all?
Definitely introvert. And I still feel like that may be my dominant quality, only because I need that recovery time after you know, I do social things or am with a lot of people or speaking engagement things. I need that time to recharge. I feel like extroverts get their energy from being around other people.
Yeah.
And so I definitely still introverted. I just know I get to plan it into things. So I understand it. And so it doesn't freak me out.
Yes, exactly. I'm bad about never making last minute plans for the same reason. I'm an introvert. Just, you know, if you give me enough heads up, I can plan for things. But otherwise, absolutely, don't expect me to be there. I'm sorry. I need more than an hour.
Agreed.
How do you celebrate your wins in life when things are really going your way and things are going great?
Oh my gosh. It's so funny that you asked me that, because just today I put out a free PDF for my community about 5 ways to celebrate without cake or champagne.
Nice. Because we're not dogs. We don't have to have treats at every good thing we do.
No, we don't have to have treats. And it's acknowledging that we get to celebrate the little things that we do. So I didn't celebrate filling that pillbox, and I should have been celebrating every Sunday when I fill that pillbox, at least a little way. So a lot of times for me, it is something quiet. So it might be blocking out time to go to the beach for me, because I don't get to go all the time and I really, really enjoy it. And so that's a really fun way for me to celebrate. I love to do it that way.
Nice. And you're in Florida, so you can actually do that. You wouldn't have been able to probably do that in Texas. They have beaches, but not as much as Florida does.
No, it is not. I went to one of the Texas beaches and I cried.
Oh,
I'm just gonna.
Oh, gosh. Well, after being in California for so long, I can see that. I lived in LA for 14 years. I get that.
Yeah.
It's not the same.
It's not the same.
It's a bay. It's not even an ocean. Come on. Yeah,
no. And I've been told I just went to the wrong area, but there were like dirty mattresses on the beach and people had driven up on the beach and had their cars like parked on the beach and empty 40 bottles. Like, I was just like, this isn't the beach.
This is a trash dump.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. My husband lived in Texas for a little while, went to the beach one day. And apparently there's a really heavy undercurrent there and it nearly killed him.
Oh, well, that's scary.
Yeah. I'm glad it didn't. I'm glad he's still here, but this was long before I ever met him. But yeah, nearly drowned in the beach of Texas. That's just nuts.
That's not the way you want to go.
No. Well, Erin, there's always one last question that I ask my guests before I let them go. It's my favorite question of the episode, always. What is one thing that you love about yourself, not related to your physical appearance?
Ooh. You know, I have received this compliment more than one time. And so I've decided it is the favorite thing about myself. People will describe me as being effervescent. And so finding humor and being able to talk about hard things with humor and wit and not complete doom and gloom. I love that about myself. I love my effervescence.
I do too. That's a great way to describe you, just from what I've learned about you.
Thank you.
Erin, your website, erincopeland.com. C-O-P-E-L-A-N-E-R-I-N-C. Erin. C-O-P-E-L-A-N. I'll make sure I have this in the show notes too, so people can find you. And your website is super cool. I was actually poking around your website earlier. The last part of your bio says she loves writing, the ocean, yoga, massage, and martinis with blue cheese olives. Amen. I love those blue cheese olives.
They're the best. I love them.
Oh my gosh, they're so good. Everybody go check out erincopeland.com. Check out her books and her blog and just go and see everything that she does. She is amazing. You guys are going to love her. Erin, thank you so much for coming on our show. I really appreciate you and I love your story and I love what you're doing to help others.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
If you've enjoyed tonight's episode, please make sure you check out the episode description. There you'll find links on how you can learn more about this guest, links to connect with them on social media, and how to support the podcast. Remember, I don't get paid to do this. My boss is a bit tight-fisted. I can say that. I work for myself. In short, this show really is all about the guest. If you've enjoyed their interview, please feel free to let them know. You can also tune in to my other podcast, Growth from Darkness, which is co-hosted by a lovely lady from Australia. We talk about what trauma responses are and healthy ways to move beyond the past. For more information, just go to growthfromdarkness.com. You can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/growthfromdarkness.